Carolina tells Sanford to take a hike, Maine voters take their time at the polls, and will Utah take in a former Massachusetts governor? Take this week's Political Junkie, please. I'm Ken Rudin. Ranked choice voting has come to Maine. Is this the future of picking candidates?
I think so. I mean, we already see a lot of cities doing this. Maine, of course, is taking it to another level. I'll say, by the way, as people see it works, I do think that we will have a lot of imitators out there.
Plus, we know all those terrible things Mitt Romney said about Donald Trump in 2016. What tone will he take if he's elected to the Senate this year?
He's a Republican and has been his entire life. He's not going to be leading the resistance against Trump. I think on a lot of issues and a lot of policies that Trump is pushing forward, Romney will be on board.
And we speak with the brother of the late civil rights leader Medgar Evers, assassinated 55 years ago this week.
Well, we both knew that is a possibility of someone trying to hurt him. And because, you know, that then we fight against segregation. And Medgar was trying to integrate, and we knew that that was a threat to a society that had been dominating for years.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 233 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We still haven't caught our breath yet from the Trump-Kim summit held this week in Singapore. In fact, we're still reeling from the incendiary taunts the two of them launched against each other last year, when talk about nuclear annihilation was as casual as talk about the weather. We also can't come to terms with the fact that the president could call Kim Jong-un a, quote, very talented man who is smart, loves his people, loves his country, while tweeting that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was dishonest and weak. Wow. And sure, we understand the importance of the art of the deal, but what did the U.S. get from North Korea in return? Trump agreed to suspend military exercises with the South, which, by the way, he called provocative, exactly what Pyongyang and Beijing have called them. But did North Korea give up anything? Anything about stopping its nuclear program, allowing inspectors in the country, a pledge to halt the testing of nuclear weapons? Not a word. One thing that is clear is that Fox News and its allies, which blistered President Obama for his willingness to talk to dictators and despots, is hailing Trump as a hero. The hypocrisy is absolutely delicious. Listen to this compilation from the Now This website. First, Fox News on Obama.
Would you, as president, meet with the leaders of a country like North Korea? Obama extraordinarily said, I'd meet with him.
Senator Obama made his intentions crystal clear on the campaign trail.
I will meet, not just with our friends, but with our enemies.
President Obama likes talking to dictators.
He would meet with some of these madmen without any preconditions.
You know, I'm going to reach out to these crazy people around the world and try to get things done.
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake.
Obama is bowing and scraping before dictators.
What is Team Obama doing establishing formal contacts with these people?
Obama would personally negotiate with leaders of terrorist nations like Iran and North Korea without preconditions. Wow.
And then Fox News on Trump and North Korea.
A remarkable turnaround in relations between two historic adversaries.
The commander-in-chief's leadership is now leading to a major foreign policy breakthrough.
Another stunning Donald Trump breakthrough.
President Trump scoring a big win.
It's time to celebrate a great victory when it happens.
President Trump proves the experts wrong again and scores a stunning diplomatic triumph.
It is a definite win for the president.
And it's a huge win for this country.
It's breathtaking, it's audacious, it's bold. It will be historic. I'm juiced about it.
It'll be magnificent for the people of Korea.
Oh my goodness, the hypocrisy. By the way, that music was added by the Now This website. You no doubt remember Mark Sanford. Back when he was governor of South Carolina, he said he was hiking the Appalachian Trail when in reality, he was meeting his soulmate in Argentina. In 2013, his political career was revived when he was elected to Congress. And since the 2016 election, Sanford has turned into a strong Trump critic. On Tuesday, that proved to be his undoing. In the afternoon, as the voting was going on, Trump tweeted that Sanford, quote, has been very unhelpful to me in my campaign to MAGA, Make America Great. He is MIA and nothing but trouble. He is better off in Argentina. Never mind the astonishing lack of self-awareness that Trump could mock Sanford for having an extramarital affair. That's for another day. But Trump went on the attack and endorsed his primary opponent, Katie Arrington, who wound up beating Sanford. As for Arrington, there was nothing subtle about her commercials.
Mark Sanford and the career politicians cheated on us. We sent him to do a job, but he left his post and set off down a long trail towards obstructionism.
If nothing else, Sanford's loss on Tuesday shows the danger of crossing Trump, giving one more example that you cross the president, you risk your political future. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party. Sanford is now the second member of Congress to be defeated for renomination this year, following a fellow Republican, Rob Pittenger of North Carolina. In horse racing news, nobody can say we're not the king of segues, Justify became not only the 13th horse to win the Triple Crown with his victory last Saturday, but he's the subject of this week's trivia question. When was the last time a horse won the Triple Crown in an election year when either the House or Senate switched party control? Do not check the Gallup poll for the answers. Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch, and the winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Oh, I never should have settled down, hanging around in a one-horse town, when Evan starts sleeping around. Oh, I never should have settled down, hanging around in a one-horse town, when Evan starts sleeping.
Maine did something out of the ordinary on Tuesday, something no other state has ever done. It changed the way voters pick nominees for statewide races. It's called ranked choice voting. Instead of simply choosing their favorite, voters have the option to rate the candidates in order of preference. In other words, if there are five candidates on the ballot, voters can give them a ranking from 1 to 5. When the ballots are counted, if the leader doesn't have a majority, then the bottom candidate is eliminated and the numbers get recalculated, continuing until one candidate has that majority. One of the reasons Maine changed the system is that, with easy access to the ballot by independent candidates, its governors often get elected without a majority of the vote. In fact, of the last 8 gubernatorial elections, only one, in 1998, when independent Angus King won a second term, did the winner get more than 50% of the vote. Rob Ritchie is the president and CEO of Fair Vote, a nonprofit organization that supports election reform. Rob, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, tell me, what prompted Maine to change its system?
Well, you're right. There's this whole history of debates about third parties and independents that goes back 40 years. I mean, so the 9 of the last 11 races for governor, one with less than 50. Each of the last 3 governors won at least one of their races with less than 40%. And so voters repeatedly went through that dilemma of, you know, do you vote for the one you like? Do you try to figure out who's ahead and, you know, and how to be calculating? And then there were frustrations with outcomes. You always have that when some people believe that someone's winning who wouldn't have won head-to-head. It's also a state with a lot of independents, a real reform history. The city of Portland, which is their biggest city, adopted ranked choice voting back in 2010 and used it for a first election for mayor in 2011, had a really interesting election. People thought it went quite well. Turnout was up. You know, voters handled it well. So it kind of made it seem more real to people. And so when they were going through yet another cycle of a governor's race with Paula Page, the current governor, who is a controversial governor who has had a string of plurality wins in his political career, some people said, you know, let's put this on the table. And there had been state legislation to do it for years. The state legislature hadn't acted on it. And so Maine advocates took it to the ballot, and It was an easy signature to get in 2014 from a lot of people frustrated by things. They won in 2016 with the second biggest vote in history of Maine on a ballot measure. And it's been a fight to get it implemented. It's quite an ups and downs roller coaster that local advocates had to pursue these last couple of years. But yes, this week was just a real triumph of persistence and, we think, for democracy.
And, of course, there are some people who are not big fans of this system. There is some controversy, but Maine voters had the opportunity on Tuesday to weigh in how they felt about it, and a sizable majority said, let's keep this system.
Exactly. I mean, it was really interesting, and I think that a key component to that victory, and this was a referendum, a people's veto, of legislation that had delayed ranked choice voting and probably would have killed it over a whole complicated debate that had gone on involving legal issues and political fights, and they finally had passed this legislation that was going to stop ranked choice voting this year and probably kill it. And the local advocates, you know, have the right in Maine to overturn a law that the people don't want to see passed. And so they collected enough signatures that suspends the law. So it meant ranked choice voting was in place in June. And then they voted on whether to reject that new law and keep ranked choice voting for certain uses. That's sort of the complicated phraseology. It was a pretty complicated ballot question. But here's the thing. Voters had a chance to vote with it first. And there's a lot of, you know, hullabaloo, like, oh, it's going to be hard and things. And voters go in, and it's not hard. It's actually quite straightforward. They had a good ballot design. Secretary of State did a good job introducing this to voters. And I think a lot of voters went in and said, oh, that was pretty easy. And I got to say more. I wasn't limited to just a single choice. I could rank my choices, and that gave me more voice. And, you know, I think that really contributed to the good vote.
But voters do have the opportunity. They had the option of just voting for their favorite, right? They don't have to rank the candidates in order of preference, correct?
Exactly. It would be somewhat analogous to, you know, voting in the first round of a runoff, and you vote for a candidate, and then if that candidate doesn't make the runoff and you don't like the candidates in the runoff, you just wouldn't come back, right? It would be something like that. So you say, well, here's my first choice. I'm indifferent to everybody else. I'm going to abstain from all my other choices. But if you have any preference among those choices, it's the smart thing to do to rank them. It never counts against your top choice. Your ballot only counts for one candidate at a time, but that second choice might help defeat your last choice. And that's sort of that's how it solves the spoiler dilemma that comes up when third parties run, because you can vote for your favorite without having to elect your least favorite, but you don't have to rank anybody beyond your first choice.
Let's say there were five candidates on the ballot, and after the first round of counting, the candidate number five is eliminated. So how do the totals for the remaining four candidates change?
They change based on what the supporters of that eliminated candidate, how they direct their ballots, right? So it uses the term instant runoff to describe the count because essentially it's like a series of runoffs where you're knocking out the last place finisher. They're out because they're in last place, and then their ballots can have another chance to count. Not for two people at a time, but just as their backup choice. So if my first choice is the fifth place finisher, and then I rank, you know, my second choice is Joe, you know, then my ballot will go to Joe. And if it was Jill, it would go to Jill. And then you count the ballots. And if you have someone who's won a majority, meaning an absolute majority of 50% plus one, then you have a winner. If not, you'd knock out the last place person who was a new last place person, right? And then you redistribute their votes and you keep going. Some cities like San Francisco does this, and they always run down to two. Even when you actually win on the first count, they still like, well, let's run it down to two to kind of clarify the definition of the mandate. You know, you always get down to that head-to-head comparison of the top two candidates, which in some ways is a good way to do it when you have the technology to.
The election for San Francisco mayor was on June 5th. I read somewhere that they're still counting. That's not true, is it?
Oh, yeah, no, they're still counting, but it has nothing to do with ranked choice voting. You may know about California. It's just they get a lot of late mail ballots, you know, vote-by-mail ballots, and a lot of provisional ballots cast on Election Day. San Francisco actually finishes its count quicker than most counties, but it's the act of processing the ballots. This mayor's race is a really, really close one, so every vote has to count. So if you have a certain number of ballots still to be processed, then you've got to finish the process before you know for sure who's won. There's great clarity at this point that London Breed is the new mayor of San Francisco, but it was super close, and so they had to really count the ballots down to the last remaining unprocessed ballots.
Not because of ranked choice voting.
Not because of ranked choice voting. Some people are thinking it is, but it actually has nothing to do with ranked choice voting.
Some people are saying that why not just have runoff for every election if no candidate won a majority, but that would be very expensive, wouldn't it?
Be expensive and actually not, we don't think, very democratic with a small d. You know, we like runoffs better than plurality because it is a chance for voters to make sure they're getting a representative outcome. The downside of runoffs, though, that can make it almost a challenging comparison even to plurality is it costs the jurisdiction money, it costs the candidates money, right? So it gives money another chance to have a say because you have everyone has to vote again. All the ads can be done again, but now more targeted on somebody. But a lot of voters don't come back. We've studied, actually, the last almost 200 runoffs now, back to 1994, for all the states that have federal runoffs for primaries, lots of southern states, for instance. And the average decline in turnout is more than 35%. Texas just had a runoff. The decline was about 50%, right? So you're having just a lot of people not coming back. And that's a great value of the instant runoff of ranked choice voting is the voters are there. They typically actually do have an opinion about more than one candidate. You ask them for it, and then you can use that to get a better outcome.
We do know that the Republican nominee for governor of Maine did get over 50%, so he is the nominee. We still don't know who the winner on the Democratic primary is yet, but Governor LePage, even while the voting was going on Tuesday, he said he was threatening not to certify the results. Can he do that?
My understanding is he can't. I guess it's going to be one of those he said, she said issues, but he has no grounds to. It was a complicated implementation of ranked choice voting because they were voting on it as well. And so people who didn't want to see ranked choice voting passed seemingly were acting, I guess, not in the full interest of helping the implementation go smoothly, I would say, like not funding it and things like that. And so Governor LePage really took it to another level with that statement. It was during Election Day. I think it was really designed to send a message to his supporters on how to vote on the measure. Let's hope that he'll sort of accept that the election has happened. It was a credible election. Turnout was up, by the way. Voters handled the ballots just fine. The procedures are very clear. They're very fair. This is a funny thing. If you read the Republican Party of Maine's bylaws on how they elect their chair, it's pretty much word for word how the ranked choice voting algorithm goes. It's really funny. And they're saying, oh, this is like this weird process. It's exactly the way that they elect their chair. The only difference is they repeatedly vote, right? They ask the people who are at a convention to vote repeatedly, but you knock out the last place person, you re-vote, you tally the results and so on. And then when you get a majority winner, you're done. And that's essentially what the ranked choice voting thing is doing without having to ask people to come back again and again and vote. You just use their rankings to simulate that.
What would you say is the big drawback or the biggest complaint against ranked choice voting?
I think in an overarching umbrella sense, it's novelty and a lot of what if kind of concerns, probably healthy for not just rushing to any change. I mean, it's frustrating as a reformer to have all these what ifs that we think have good answers, but it means that we don't just willy-nilly do things that affect voting. So it goes through a process of being used, being examined, people being concerned. I think that there's sort of a knee-jerk belief that act of asking people to rank or offering them opportunity will be harder for some voters than others. We don't think that's true. The evidence doesn't seem to support that. And certainly in comparison to alternatives, which I think is always a good way to see it, we're not comparing it to nothing. We're comparing it to whatever, to something else. In comparison to those something else, ranked choice voting seems to do quite well. We think it's better than plurality, where you just vote for one person, a single choice. That person can win with, say, in the Democratic race for governor, the person would be winning with less than 35%. And maybe they're the right person to win, but maybe not. And it's good to find out and give the voters who have preferences a chance to express them. And then when you compare them to runoffs, again, all those issues involving expense and so on, when you just look at other ways that you could vote, we just think ranked choice voting is a proven, effective system.
As Maine goes, so goes the rest of the country?
I think so. I mean, we already see a lot of cities doing this. Maine, of course, is taking it to another level. I'll say, by the way, this is going to be a really interesting November election. And so U.S. Senate, there's an independent senator from Maine, Angus King. He will be facing both a Democrat and a Republican nominee. So it'll be a three-candidate race. So that's one where the ranked choice system really makes sense. And then you have two congressional races, and in both of them, you have state legislators, current state legislators, where maybe one I think is a recent one, but anyway, people of real standing who are running outside the major parties. So you'll have three candidate races in both congressional districts as well, and they'll use ranked choice voting. I think as people look at that and see it works, I do think that we will have a lot of imitators out there. You know, here's an interesting little tidbit. Five states this spring, and they're pretty surprising, are using ranked choice voting at the federal level, but in a very targeted way. It's overseas voters. Like in South Carolina, they just had a primary, and they have a runoff that's pretty quick turnaround. And the reason they can do that quick turnaround time is they send their overseas voters a ranked choice ballot. And then in the event of a runoff, and there's like a gubernatorial runoff, and there's, you know, some congressional runoffs, they don't need to send ballots back again to those overseas voters because they've already returned their ranked choices. And they've done that for more than a decade in, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana. They all are doing that in federal offices. So it's, in some ways, that principle of a ranked ballot is actually more widespread than we might think.
Rob Ritchie is the co-founder, president, and CEO of FairVote, a nonprofit organization that supports election reform. For more information, go to fairvote.org. Rob, thanks so much for explaining ranked choice voting for us.
Thank you, Ken.
Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Ooh, what's that you say, Mrs. Robinson? Joe to Joe has left and gone away. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
By all accounts, Mitt Romney is on his way to becoming the next senator from Utah. The 2012 Republican presidential nominee, he was born in Michigan and served as the governor of Massachusetts, but he moved to the heavily Mormon state of Utah 4 years ago and was in the right place at the right time when Senator Orrin Hatch announced his retirement in January. But then something happened at the state convention last April. A relatively unknown state representative, Mike Kennedy, actually won the party endorsement, defeating Romney 51-49. Here's a report from Fox News.
Surprise upset in Utah, where former presidential candidate Mitt Romney failed to lock down the nomination for the U.S. Senate, or at least the Republican nomination, and is now forced into a June runoff on the 26th in a primary.
Can Romney be defeated in the June 26th primary? Brian Schott is the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com and has been following the race. Brian, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
It's nice to be here.
Well, tell me, what did Romney's defeat at the state convention tell us? What did we learn?
I don't think it really told us very much. This is just the latest pattern in convention delegates here in Utah who are much further to the right than the Republican electorate as a whole, choosing someone either to make a point or to try and push forward someone who they know is more to the right politically than the mainstream candidate. They don't much go for the mainstream. This thing happened back in 2016. Governor Gary Herbert, who has a 70% approval rating here in the state, was defeated at convention by a far-right candidate, Jonathan Johnson. But Governor Herbert was able to use our unique system of getting on the ballot, and he gathered the 28,000 signatures statewide he needed in order to secure a spot on the primary ballot, much like Mitt Romney did. And in the primary in 2016, Herbert cruised to an easy win. That's probably going to happen here as well. Mitt Romney is insanely popular, but when you get 4,000 delegates who are selected in Tuesday night meetings that can last anywhere from 1 hour to 3 hours, and you get about 4,000 of them in a room, and it's very hard to go to these neighborhood meetings to become a delegate, you know, you're going to get people who are sort of the hardcore elements of the party.
Now, Mike Kennedy's running as a solid Trump backer, and yet the president has endorsed Romney. I guess one of the questions is, why did the president even get involved?
Well, if you remember, the president was trying to convince Orrin Hatch to run again for another term to try and keep Romney out of the race. But the reason that Romney got into this is when Hatch started to think about retirement, he actually pitched Romney on the idea of running for his seat. So this has been in the works for a while. Romney has been a critic of the president, and Romney has, I guess, if you look at some of the public opinion polling and the election results here in Utah, we recently did our latest job approval rating of President Trump, and here in Utah, he's only at 47%. Now, that's significant because in 2016, Trump won Utah with 45% of the vote. So his approval rating has not moved much. I think the highest we've seen it since his election was 48%. So he still has not crossed 50. Utah is still the most anti-Trump Republican state in the union. So they're very Republican, but they're not really on board the Trump train right now. And that's going to give Romney some leeway. But once it looked clear that Romney was going to get into this, Trump did endorse him on Twitter. And I think that was just a little bit of opportunism by Trump, because every single question was going to be Romney versus Trump, Romney versus Trump. I think Romney welcomed the endorsement because it took that out of the notebook of reporters like me, so we don't ask him every single time that we see him, and we can talk about other issues.
Well, is one of the issues the fact that he's being painted by Kennedy as a carpetbagger?
Yeah, he is being painted as a carpetbagger. He was painted as a carpetbagger when he ran for governor in Massachusetts as well. That's just goes with the territory, but he's had a home here for 4 years. Romney cemented his legacy here in Utah when he saved the 2002 Winter Olympics. And after that point, he probably could have been elected president of the entire state, king here in Utah. After that happened, Utah loved him so much that he could have been declared king for life. But you don't launch a presidential campaign from Utah, at least you don't in 2004 or whenever he decided to run. So he went to Massachusetts because that's a better platform for that sort of thing.
Well, I know that Kennedy and Romney have had a series of debates so far. And as you have pointed out, as in my conversations with you, Romney debated a Kennedy once before, right?
Yes. If he wins, he would move his record to 1-1 versus candidates named Kennedy. He did lose to Kennedy in Massachusetts when he ran for U.S. Senate back then.
I just thought I'd offer this little piece of tape here as a flashback.
I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country. I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years, that we should sustain and support it. And I sustain and support that law and the right of a woman to make that choice.
On the question of the choice issue, I have supported the Roe v. Wade. I am pro-choice. My opponent is multiple choice.
Brian, of course, that was a different Mitt Romney and certainly a different Kennedy.
Yeah, it was certainly a different Mitt Romney. And that's one of the things that Romney has going against him. There's so much political history for him and his opponents on social media are dredging this up everywhere. I mean, the dedicated hashtag for politics here in the state is just sort of a cesspool of people attacking Romney constantly and bringing up some really, really terrible things from his past. And it's kind of hard to go in and see what's actually happening in politics. But, you know, that's one of the things that Romney has going against him. But it's not gaining any traction here in the state. Utahns, by and large, like Romney, even when we look at a number of our polling, even about a quarter of Democrats in the state really like Romney. And that's going to hurt his Democratic opponent, Jenny Wilson, who has already secured the nomination on the Democratic side. If she's already lost a quarter of her base, and Democrats, she can't afford to lose even one of them if she's going to have even a shot. But if she's already lost a quarter of Democrats who favor Romney over her, she's in a lot of trouble.
I know we still have a primary to go through on June 26th. We have an election in November. But, of course, there's a lot of anticipation on what kind of a senator Romney will be. And I guess what made me think of this is we saw what happened in South Carolina on Tuesday when Mark Sanford, a Trump critic, was defeated in the primary. So there's questions whether Romney, who has said critical things about Trump in the past, will he be the spokesperson for the Never Trump Republicans, or will he just simply be a leader of the establishment and just stay away from controversy when it involves Trump? What do you think?
So, you've seen a lot of reporting from Romney's confidants that he is sort of sees himself in the Senate in the mold of a John McCain, a Jeff Flake, sort of a big role in the mainstream Republican Party. But let's not forget, he's a Republican and has been his entire life. He's not going to be leading the resistance against Trump. I think he'll pick his spots, speak out against Trump when Trump says something that he disagrees with personally. But I think on a lot of issues and a lot of policies that Trump is pushing forward, Romney will be on board. Now, trade might be an issue. Romney is a big proponent of free trade, and he might clash with Trump when it comes to some of these tariffs. Immigration might be another issue because the LDS Church is in favor of helping refugees. So that could be another point of contention. But for the most part, I think Romney's going to keep his head down and be a very effective senator and be able to get things done, because even though he'll be the junior senator from Utah behind Mike Lee, he's not going to be a junior senator. He's got a vast fundraising network. He'll be able to help out Republicans, and he's going to be a player when he gets back there.
Brian Schott is the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com. He's covering the Romney-Kennedy Republican primary for the Senate, which takes place June 26. Brian, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Anytime.
Last week's primary for governor of California took me back to another California gubernatorial contest more than three decades ago. It was in 1982 when Governor Jerry Brown was giving up his job to run for the Senate. The battle to succeed Brown was between George Dukmejian, the Republican state attorney general, and Thomas Bradley, the Democratic mayor of Los Angeles. Dukmejian was white and Bradley was black, which, at the time, seemed crucial to who was going to win. The polls showed Bradley winning, but it was Dukmejian who pulled off the upset. The election led to what widely came to be known as the Bradley effect, an election where the contest is between a white and black candidate, where the black candidate is ahead in the polls but loses in November, and the reason given is that voters were always planning on voting for the white candidate, but were wary about telling pollsters that they were going to vote against the black candidate. This Bradley effect has been part of the lexicon ever since 1982. Here's Michelle Obama in 2008 on CNN's Larry King Live.
So look where we are, Larry. Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee. If there was going to be a Bradley effect, or if it was going to be in play, Barack wouldn't be the nominee.
CBS's Katie Couric talked about it with Barack Obama 2 days before the 2008 election.
There's been a debate about the Bradley effect, which, as you know, in essence, is when some respondents lie to pollsters and say, sure, we'd vote for an African-American candidate, but on election day, they just don't do it. A lot of people say it's a phenomenon that's outdated, overstated, and misunderstood. Having said that, do you think we'll see evidence of that on election day?
You know, I have to tell you, I'm in the camp that says it's outdated and overstated.
The topic actually spread worldwide.
Για το γιατί οι δημοσκοπήσεις πέφτουν έξω. Πείτε μας.
Ναι, υπάρχει το φαινόμενο Bradley Effect, το οποίο έχω και ένα σχετικό άρθρο στο πρώτο θέμα GR, στη Steel Group Therapy.
But was the Bradley Effect real? A closer look at that race suggests maybe not. I thought about that a few weeks ago when Dukmejian died at age 89. Upon closer look, Bradley's lead over Dukmejian was, in reality, rapidly declining. Plus, there was a ballot measure about guns that year that helped explain Dukmejian's comeback. Ken Kachigian was a Dukmejian strategist who says what more and more historians have been saying, that the Bradley effect was just a myth.
Glad to have an opportunity to put the dagger in the heart of this urban legend. So I'm happy to have this opportunity. The so-called Bradley effect, our pollster Lance Terrence has called it, it's a theory in search of data. The dynamics of the campaign was that the campaign was going into the final weeks. Bradley was cruising towards what he thought was an election victory. He was smug. He was complacent. Some papers were already talking about him being a vice presidential running mate for someone. And so he was running sort of a lazy campaign. Our campaign manager resigned 3 weeks out before the campaign. So our backs were to the wall, and so we couldn't play defense anymore. So our campaign started hitting much harder, and we started to go on the offense. We had a big infusion of cash from supporters, from loyal supporters, and this enabled us to run a whole new series of ads that we hadn't done before. I was the message maker at that time, so I drafted two new commercials geared towards exploiting Tom Bradley's two central weaknesses in the campaign. One was the stated antipathy towards Los Angeles, which was showing up throughout our polls. And the second thing was that Bradley had a very big weakness because he was perceived as a liberal. Or on the second matter, he opposed the death penalty in California and also the California Victims' Bill of Rights, which had been approved on the ballot, both supported very strongly by voters in California. And Dick Majan was actually endorsed by four former police chiefs of Los Angeles, actually, who had worked in the Tom Bradley Police Department. So Bradley had that going against him. On the antipathy towards L.A., our polls were showing very strongly that in San Francisco, in San Diego, and in suburbs across the state, not to mention the San Joaquin Valley, that there was negative feelings towards Los Angeles. And there was a fact working against Bradley. No Los Angeles mayor has been elected governor in modern California history. So he had that working against him. The other thing, as you and I have discussed before, is there was a proposition on the ballot, Prop 15, which was going to bring gun control into California. So the NRA registered 300,000 new voters, and this mobilized a whole new base of voters in California. Then you have the San Joaquin Valley, which Bradley was very foreign to Bradley. He supported Cesar Chavez and the Great Boycotts, and he was very much tied to the very unpopular Governor Jerry Brown, who had no sympathizers in the San Joaquin Valley. So we were very strong in the San Joaquin Valley. Then there was another factor that everybody missed, and that was that our state GOP chairman, Tirso Del Junco, put together an unprecedented absentee voter campaign, which nobody had caught. And he had put together 50% more absentee voters than ever before. And so, although Bradley won on Election Day, he was swamped by these absentee votes as they came in on the election night and on the days after the election.
Assuming everything you say is true, and I've read a lot of historians saying exactly that he won because of the backlash against the gun initiative, that Jerry Brown was unpopular, that he was cruising and not taking the seriously. There was an absentee ballot effort put up by your campaign. Why are we still talking about the Bradley effect? Why is that still part of the political lexicon?
Well, it's hard to understand. I think people were so shocked by Bradley's loss because they expected him to win that they had to come up with an excuse. They had to come up with some reason to explain it. And the reason they attached to it was racial discrimination, frankly. And so instead of the hard word of bigotry, they gave the soft word of the Bradley effect.
Ken Kachigian was a senior strategist to George Duke Majan, the California Republican who was elected governor in 1982 and reelected in a landslide 4 years later. Duke Majan died May 8th at the age of 89. Ken, thank you so much for being on the program.
Enjoyed doing it, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last female member of Congress to lose her seat in a primary? The answer, Corinne Brown. A Democrat from Florida, Brown was under indictment on fraud charges when she was defeated in the primary by Al Lawson on August 30, 2016. Lawson went on to win the seat, which he still holds. And the randomly selected winner is David Miller of Berkeley, California. David wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Last week's contest led off with a Thanks Cal button for Cal Ripken of the Baltimore Orioles. It was followed by a We Love McGov button for George McGovern, one that read Kumquats Make You Horny, which I guarantee has never been used in a scuttlebutt puzzle before, an often used button with the letter A on it, one button that said, New York's prime candidate, Bob Wagner, and finally, a Mary Moshari button from New Jersey. That's a lot of buttons. So when you combine Cal, love, horny, prime Mary, you kind of get California primary, which just so happens occurred last week. And the winner is Louisa Bushy of Florence, Massachusetts. We'll have a new scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
I am Governor Jerry Brown. I aura smiles and never frown. Soon I will be president. Out of power, I'll sweep the way. I will be fearless.
It's time for This Week in Political History. 1963 will always be remembered for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But he was not the only American leader gunned down that year. On June 12, 1963, civil rights leader Medgar Evers, a field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi, was shot to death in the driveway of his home in Jackson. The killer was Byron Dilla Beckwith, a white supremacist who wasn't convicted of the crime until 30 years later. Throughout his life, Medgar Evers fought hard for the right of everyone to vote.
We're not just interested in voting so that conditions will be improved for Negroes. We want conditions improved for everybody.
And he knew, as a black man in Mississippi, he was taking a risk.
I've had a number of threatening calls, people calling me saying that they were going to kill me, saying that they were going to blow my home up, and saying that I only had a few hours to live.
On the night of June 11th, 1963, in the aftermath of the tension of admitting black students to the University of Alabama, where Governor George Wallace briefly stood in the front of the schoolhouse door before giving way, President Kennedy gave his first radio TV address to the nation about civil rights.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free. And when Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation, such as hotels and restaurants and theaters and retail stores, without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal.
It was an inspiring speech. The next night, Medgar Evers was gunned down in his own driveway. The assassination shook the country. Here's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the murder.
The brutal murder of Medgar Evers came as shocking and tragic news to all people of goodwill, especially after such an eloquent and profound and unequivocal plea for justice and human dignity for all people by the President of the United States. I think this reveals that we still have a long, long way to go in this nation before we achieve the ideals of decency and the ideals of brotherhood.
Charles Evers is Medgar's older brother. After the assassination, he got into politics himself. In 1969, he was elected mayor of Fayette, Mississippi, the first African-American ever elected mayor in the state. He served 16 years in office. In 1971, he ran for governor, and in 1978, he sought an open Senate seat, both times running as an independent. These days, he's a Republican, and he is 95 years old. And we welcome him to the Political Junkie. Of course, we wish the circumstances were different. Charles Evers, it is wonderful having you on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, the assassination of your brother took place in 1963, 55 years ago this week. What do you remember of that day or of those days in Mississippi?
Well, first of all, it took place because Medgar was fighting for equal rights only. It wasn't for black rights or white rights, but for rights, equally anyone else. And because of that, the racists and the bigots of this state decided that they could get rid of him and stop the movement. And that's why that they got together and got this ignorant white man to kill Medgar. All they did was speed it up. They didn't stop a thing. It made us determined to come back here and make sure Mississippi become the state of inclusion of everybody, black and white, rich and poor.
You know, when earlier in the introduction, I played a little piece of your brother talking about that he kind of knew that people were out to do him harm. Did he have that fear? Did he express that concern about his safety?
Well, we both knew that is a possibility of someone trying to hurt him, and we always knew that. Yes, he knew that, and because, you know, that then we fight against segregation, and at that time, everything in Mississippi was segregated. White folks here and black folks there. And Medgar was trying to integrate and get us the right to vote and the right to participate and be elected officials, to be a part of Mississippi as any other person. And we knew that was a threat to a society that had been dominating for years. And yes, we knew that.
Clearly, 1963, it was not a great time being a black political activist in the state of Mississippi. What's your memory of the risks that you and your brother took back then?
Well, the risk was that we were threatened every day. Medgar, in particular, after I had gotten in financial trouble, I had to go to Chicago to make some money. They kept threatening Medgar and kept getting calls and all that kind of silly stuff. And they kept threatening him. And then finally it happened. And Medgar and I had agreed if anything happened to either one of us, the other one would take over and carry on the fight for equality for colored. We were colored then, you know. We changed over 10 years. We were colored folks then, but for colored. And that's just what happened. When they killed Medgar, I came down that night, and I haven't been back to my business in Chicago since.
You went into politics after your brother's death. Had he lived, would he have run for office, do you think?
I don't know. That's hard to say. Medgar was more or less a person that opened doors. I don't know how much of a politician he could make because he wasn't much of a dealer. You know, we didn't deal. It ain't. And that's the kind of person he was. And, you know, in politics, you sort of had a wheeling deal, and you do something else. I don't know if Medgar would have or not. I just don't know.
You know, I remember back in 1971 when you ran for governor, and then in 78 in the seat that Thad Cochran won, the Senate seat. But I remember that you were running as an independent. These days, you've become a Republican, and you even endorsed Donald Trump. What attracted you to the Republican Party?
First of all, the Republican Party, let me make it clear to y'all that you understand this. It was the Republican Party that got us the right to vote. They got helped pass the civil rights bill, helped us the voter rights bill. The Democrats fought us like hell. Easton, Stennis, John Barry Williams, Strong Thumb, all the more Democrats over up in Washington did not support the voter rights bill or the civil rights bill. It was the Republicans who did. And that's there's products from Illinois and California and other places. And that's why I became a Republican, because they're the ones supporting me. Equal rights.
And actually, Thad Cochran, if I remember, he went out of his way to attract African-American voters.
Right. And I beat him. He beat me, but, you know, I came in second close to him.
Yeah, I remember that. You've seen a lot in your life. What memory sticks with you the most regarding politics? What do you remember the most?
I think the thing that, I don't know any one particular thing, but the main thing I know now is that black and white Mississippians are closer together than ever. We've always been close, but it's because he is a Negro and I'm white. But now it's not like that. We have blacks and whites. Just today I had lunch with some white friends of mine who I knew 30 years ago wouldn't have looked at me. Things have changed because white people look at us now more or less as a Mississippian, not more as one of their servants. But back in those days, we were their servants, and they're wherever they need us to be. But we have become independent enough, and things have changed enough that white people began to accept most of us as James, as Charles Evans, Jim Evans, whoever. Not no more of that nigger.
Do you think your brother, do you think Medgar would recognize Mississippi had he still been alive, you know, from 1963 to 2018? Would he recognize Mississippi?
I think he'd be just like I am, proud and surprised. He'd be proud to know that his fight was not in vain and that we are now closer together in a relationship with people, period, not just black and white people, working together and living together than we were in 1963.
Now, there are some people, of course, who will say that Donald Trump is not somebody who brings people together, but you definitely disagree with that.
No, come on. What the hell are they talking about? He didn't bring people together. Donald Trump, 46% of his employees, listen good now, and all his agencies are owned by black folks. The one in Chicago is 72%, I understand. And the one in Miami, you know, all over. What the hell are they talking about? He doesn't like black. Who does like black folks? Black folks don't like black folks. Did it within 20 since January 1 of this year in Jackson, Mississippi, 39 has been killed. What the hell are they talking about? He's no more in love with us than we are in love with ourselves. Yes, I like Trump because he's a businessman. And he's going to bring business to our state, and we're 50% of this state. If you bring business here, we're going to get some jobs, and he pay good.
I found it interesting that there were a sizable number of Barack Obama voters who voted for Donald Trump in 2016. That was interesting.
Well, let me say this, as a black man, what did Barack Obama do for black folk? Uh-huh. Name me something he did special. Name me how many blacks he point to top positions.
Well,
I know you can't answer that because he didn't point any of it.
Well, but I will tell you, but it is fascinating that when I think of 1963, when I think of what was going on with the police and blacks in Mississippi and 63, you must have seen some amazing changes in the 55 years since then.
I have, and they all been better, not worse. And back in those days, it was just white people just ignorant and didn't know any better. And I used to tell them when I'd be speaking in the public around white, you know, how you hate us and we take care of your babies while you go out and get drunk, you and your wife. We take care, we fix your food every morning. We cook your, and we take care of your cows and your horses and things. Why are you going to hate somebody that does all that? And they could answer that. We're the best friend y'all ever had and ever will have. I tell them that all the time, the white audience.
Charles Evers is the former mayor of Fayette, Mississippi. Charles Evers, it was absolutely an honor having you on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased.
It was 55 years ago this week, on June 12th, 1963, that the younger brother of Charles Evers, civil rights leader Medgar Evers, was assassinated outside his home in Jackson, Mississippi. Medgar's wife and three young children were inside at the time. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.